Thanks for downloading the Threads Church podcast. For more information, visit threadschurch.org.
As we talk about this series, and we thought about this idea of how God, you know, the four relationships broken in the fall with God and self and others and with creation, and we've been focusing on the physical aspect of creation in terms of the environmental concerns that are there and everything. But the other part of that in Genesis is not only to care for and cultivate kind of the physical world, but also really it's to create culture. And so art and beauty and form and community, and these things are also part of what it means to cultivate and bring out the goodness of God's good world. And so thought about going into the series about trying to kind of layer both of those things on, and just realize there's way too much to try to do both of that. So we focused on the environmental part, this physical creation that we're in, and really in some ways the series we're going to be doing after our 20-year anniversary next weekend is focusing more on the culture. What does it mean for us to be a certain kind of people and to cultivate a certain kind of way of being in the world? But part of what comes with creation is just beauty. And we, as those made in the image of a creator, are creative beings. And now many of us don't think of ourselves as artists because they think, I've got to be like really good at something to be an artist. I've got to like be willing to let other people see my sketches or read my poetry or whatever it is. And I'm not good enough to do it professionally or for other people to admire it. So therefore, like, I must not be an artist. And I want to push back against that a little bit, this idea that really we are all made in the image of a creator. And around us all the time is evidence that God is this created person and that we are also intended to be creators, sub-creators. We don't make out of nothing. We don't speak and then things come into existence. But we take this world, this thing that God has given us, and we shape it. And whether that's decorating your home, whether that's, you know, doodling in the margins of your notes at school, whatever it is, we are intended to be creative. And so I just would encourage you to flex those muscles. That's part of what it means. And it's going to be different for each person, and it doesn't have to be like publishable or like presentable in a museum somewhere. That's only one form of art. And we've highlighted it and elevated it and thought anything that falls short of that just doesn't matter. And I just want to push back against that. It's like, find your way to just be creative, whether that be journaling, drawing, painting, taking pictures, whatever it is that is there. So I want you to press into that. And as an example, I'm going to share something this morning, and this really comes out of experience. When I was in grad school out in Vancouver, we lived right next to this beautiful, old-growth, temperate rainforest. So they had these towering Douglas firs and cedars, and we lived right on the edge of it. It was the University Endowment Lands. It was called Pacific Spirit Regional Park. And we lived literally one house off of one end of it, and then the school was that I was going to was on UBC's campus, University of British Columbia, kind of out on the edge of the peninsula. And so it would be about a 45-minute walk, about half an hour of it in this old-growth rainforest. And regularly I would walk to and from class and just get the chance to kind of be in this amazing place. And I remember I wrote a poem about an experience of just kind of standing, and you got to understand, in this temperate rainforest in Pacific Northwest, it is green. It's shockingly, overwhelmingly, almost violently green all year long. I remember looking, like, it was like January, and I'm walking by, and I'm seeing like a new growth, like just budding, and I'm going, this place is just never stops growing. This is like the land of no winter. It's just always spring. It's always green. It's always growing. And I remember reflecting on just how that was as I'm standing in the middle of this, looking out. And because these firs and cedars are so tall and they get so much of the light just kind of filters through. There's not a lot of undergrowth. And there's just all these ferns and mosses and stuff at your feet. And so I felt like I was wading in green under a sky of green, with these pillars holding it up. And I just remember just being overwhelmed by that and thinking about it. And so there's pictures, all the pictures are from Pacific Spirit Regional Park, not my own pictures, but that I've found. And I'm just going to share this. This just is a way of kind of hammering in again this idea of just getting out into creation, building an awareness of, but really what starts with an experience of the natural world that too often we cut ourselves off from and we aren't immersed in. And so as an example of that, I just offer this poem. It's called Being Greened. Frozen in the land of eternal summer, I stand rooted and vertical between two strata of green, a mist of it at my feet, and clouds of it billowing beyond my reach. Not all is green. Underneath and behind it all is the textured canvas of browns, providing form on which green has been brushed, sprayed, and splattered in all its monochromatic glory. For even from the brown of decay, green springs forth afresh in tender shoots. Yet green fails me. Lacking capacity to contain the rich varieties of hues, tints, and shades which I find arrayed before me in this place. Forest, Kelly, Hunter, Jade, and dozens more which Crayola couldn't capture in a 10,000 crayon set. Some shades set in deep shadows, while in others light sprinkles and settles like dew. Yet diversity remains focused here, and the choices remain only two, for autumnal colors have no place where summer is endlessly new. And I marvel at this tyrannical green, cloying and covering and choking, and start to wonder if I'm slowly being incorporated and colorated into the scene. If I'm being greened. For in addition to the sight of green, which is spread here in such extravagance, and raking fingers of the breeze ruffles in the plumage of the trees, and my ears feast on the sound of green, and this same breath gently bears to my nose the green's scent, filled with bitter growings and sweet dyings that echo in my memory and awaken in my tongue, to the earthy and to the herbal, the flavor of green. Oh, and my fingers do yearn to encounter green's textures once more, its berber and its shag, its veined and its waxy, its piercing thorns and its silken caresses. Indeed, even my words, when they come, compose a prayer of green awe, green wonder, and green praise to the maker of green, who made it make so much sense. Yeah. So as we continue and look at this reality of being caretakers of God's world, that's really this series has been about. Creation waits is taken from that Romans 8 passage where Paul describes creation as waiting for the children of God to be revealed. It's groaning, it's waiting for something new to come out, and what it's waiting for is what it was created for, which was to be cared for and tended by those made in God's image who've been entrusted with this world. And so we've really been walking through this series. This is the last week we're going to be talking about it, and we started with that creation narrative in Genesis 1, how God formed and filled this good world and created humans to serve and keep it, and bring out that goodness that was intended to spread throughout creation. And we talked about how creation reveals the glory of God, and humans are called to serve as priests that allow creation to glorify God as it was created to. So that worship that begins as we just allow ourselves to be in awe and wonder of the creation. And then we looked a couple weeks ago at how creation is groaning, subjected to frustration because humans have not played the role that they were designed to play. And with all the problems in the headlines, all the doom and the gloom and predictions about imminent catastrophic environmental collapse, the Bible helps us to see what's underneath the science and the technology, that the environmental crisis is at heart a heart problem, a problem with how human nature has been twisted and bent in on itself and with selfishness, greed, and apathy, and how our hope is in heart change, that the power of God is able to transform human nature and help us to become the children of God that creation is waiting for. And so last week, as we considered about how we could enjoy creation as a gift, we also talked about this countercultural practice, this radical practice of Sabbath, and how it helps us to be formed into the renewed humanity that is the hope of creation. And so as we finish the series today, we're going to be considering what commitments God is leading us to make and where this whole creation is headed. And it's going to take the shape of a covenant. I first wrote this as like a covenant with creation. Now, a covenant is like a treaty or a binding relationship between people. And so I was thinking about covenant with creation, and I realized, no, actually, it's not a covenant with creation. It's a covenant with God about creation or for creation, on behalf of creation, that we are called to make. And the image there is really, it's an example of a covenant treaty from, I think, Hittite culture, similar ancient Near East culture, cast in bronze, and the words of it are written on there, and you see the chains, this kind of binding commitment. This would have been a reminder. And usually what happened with these covenants is that they had a number of features. Usually what would happen is that, okay, some king would come in, fight another king, defeat that king, and set themselves up as kind of the greater king, the over king. I think the word is suzerain, officially is the word, but kind of an emperor over all these kingdoms. And so then, okay, now I defeated you. Now we're going to have a relationship. We're going to have this covenant where you're going to give me treaty. If I ask you for soldiers, you're going to provide them for me. And in return, I will keep you safe, and all these things will happen. But this is going to be the relationship. So they identify, hey, I'm this king that conquered you. You are this king that I'm humbly allowing to live. There's a narrative about how great I am and how I came in and just laid waste, and you bowed before my awesome power. And then there's the terms of the covenant. Okay, this is how this is going to play out. This is what you're going to owe me, and this is what I will offer you in my beneficence as this over-ruler. And then there's usually in there this kind of a list of blessings and curses. Like, so hey, if you keep this covenant, things are going to go really well. Your flocks are going to increase. The harvest will never fail. All these things are going to happen because everything will be right in the world. But if you don't, I will come in and I will make sure that not a stone stands upon another, and that your grandchildren will look back and rue the day that you chose not to do this, if you have any grandchildren. And so oftentimes, sometimes vividly and sometimes very specifically, what would happen to you if you don't observe the terms of this covenant? And then often there were memorials or some way to remember it. You might stand a stone up and say, remember, this kind of reminds everybody that I beat you down and now you owe me this, and this is our covenant. So you'll see the stone and remember how great I am and that you owe me all this stuff. So, or they might set memorials in time. There might be, you know, once a year you're going to read this covenant and remind yourselves of how you got into this situation and where you are and what you owe me. Or it might be a festival or a feast or something that is related to that. And then oftentimes at the end, there's kind of this call to commitment. So this is kind of the shape that these covenants took in the ancient Near East. And actually, if you look at the book of Deuteronomy, it's really structured off of this as a covenant treaty between God and his people. There's a lot of these features in the sense of, like, he identifies who he is and who they are. He talks about how he's brought them out of Egypt, how he's doing this. He gives them the Ten Commandments and then various other laws about, this is my expectations of you. This is how you are going to live as my people. There's a series of blessings and curses. What will go well or what won't if you keep this covenant that I'm making with you today. And then Moses stands up and says, look, I'm putting before you the option. Death or life, blessing or curses. Like, choose life, do the right thing. And there's the call to commitment and sometimes the renewal of that commitment. There's also memorials, standing stones. There's festivals, the festivals that are set up in Deuteronomy, the Feast of Tabernacles and Passover and all these things to remind them of their story, to remind them of their relationship with God and what it means to be his people and how they're called to live by his laws. So Deuteronomy follows that pattern. We're going to kind of follow that pattern loosely this morning in this idea of making a covenant with God over creation, responding to this call to be the children of God, to be the ones that creation is waiting for. And so, you know, in this covenant, there's the parties are God, the creator, sustainer, redeemer, and king. We've in Colossians 1, a few weeks ago, we looked at the beginning of Colossians 1, that we had the end of that passage this morning in the as the first word, but talks about how everything was created through Christ, and it's all in him, and it's all for him, and he holds all things together, that this whole creation is centered on Christ, is being redeemed by Christ who came and died, and by his blood all things are going to be redeemed and restored. And so this is the God who has come and conquered. He conquered through his death. But he's come, he's invaded this creation that he made, and he has conquered, and he has called us now to submit and recognize him as king. And so that's the other party to the covenant, is us as humans, as caretakers, stewards, entrusted gardeners, agreeing to serve and protect and multiply and spread the goodness of this creation. And there's a narrative, the narrative of Scripture, the narrative of the God who created this world for our good and for his glory. God who gave it to us as gift and responsibility. And even though we've often failed in our vocation, our calling to serve and protect and assist the flourishing of God's good world, even though we've failed, he remains a faithful provider, sustainer, and redeemer. And God himself entered creation through the incarnation. And Jesus' life, death, and resurrection has not only secured our own salvation and place as God's beloved children, it has also begun the process of renewing and restoring all things through Christ's blood shed on the cross. So we proclaim our allegiance to Christ as King of creation and offer ourselves to be his representatives. This is the story behind how we got to this place in this relationship. And I'm going to hand out, here's our green Ten Commandments with our green Charlton Heston holding them. If I could have someone hand these out. So we have, on this I've kind of tongue-in-cheek put our terms of the covenant. On the one side you'll see the Ten Commandments of creation care. And I'm not going to go through all of them kind of word for word. There's advice, there's things, there's directions, there's things that we need to be considering. I'm going to point out the structure follows the same structure as the Ten Commandments. The first three relate to our relationship with God in particular. For our covenant here is worship the Lord only, because while creation is to be cared for and loved and delighted in, it is not a God, it is not our mother, it's more like a little sister, because we have the same Father, and so we delight and protect in the creation that we've been given. So just like the real Ten Commandments, it begins with worshiping God and thanking that for him. And then the second, respect the goodness of creation. And the third, not misusing creation, like not misusing the Lord's name. The fourth is the same as the real Ten Commandments, and it's that Sabbath observance that we talked about last week. And so if you're curious about why that fits with creation care and you didn't hear the talk last week, you could go back and listen to that online. And then the last ones are really kind of about our relation to creation and those who share it with us, both human and non-human. So there's things like, thou shalt not waste, thou shalt eat mercifully. Think about how you eat and what is the implications of how the food got to you. Should not use incandescent light bulbs. It's about conserving electricity and all the different ways that we do it. Not taking 20-minute showers is about conserving water. I shall not use plastic when possible. And that's, again, kind of expanding on the waste thing, but it's about reusing and about reducing and recycling where we can. And then thou shalt not spend all day in the car. Think about how we use or overuse cars and ways that we can reduce some of that as well. So this obviously isn't exhaustive. It isn't everything in there. It's intended to be somewhat humorous. But also to kind of give us a sense of these are ways of our being in the world that have an impact, and we need to consider them, and we need to think about how we live in these ways. One thing I did not include in there that I easily could have would be kind of more in the lines of like advocacy. It's kind of embedded in some of those a little bit, but learning about the products we consume and the companies that produce them and choosing to give our money to some and not to others, trying to support local and ethical and environmentally conscious options where we can, and as well as pressuring companies and government to make changes and act, since our individual footprints are massively overshadowed by the impacts of companies and countries. So that could have been a separate one, but I think it kind of overlays a lot of them. So not only does this as individuals, but how do we as a people and how do we as a country and the people in the world live these out and encourage others to live in light of these. So I want to take a quick second here and just have you turn around to maybe two or three other people around you. Not huge groups because you're not going to have a lot of time. I do want everyone to have a chance to talk about it. But just did a quick scanning of this list, and obviously you haven't had it for more than 5 minutes. But at a quick scan, like, which of these is hardest for you? Which of these things is maybe an area where you feel like you need to make some changes? Is there something on here where you're like, I really struggle to be aware of that. I know I should be better in that. It's not about guilt, but it's kind of about awareness. If you're to narrow down into one of these, if you're going to make a change in one of these areas or felt like one of these areas needed the most change, which would it be? So just share with someone next to you, like I said, groups of two, three, maybe four, but you're only going to have a few minutes, and it would be good to allow everyone to have a chance to share. So if you notice on the other side of that sheet, there is a few questions for you to be thinking about as far as a specific commitment. As I said at the beginning of this series is really more about us actually living differently. It's not so much about us learning something, which is part of it, experiencing something, which might be part of it, but a lot of it is, this is more of a hands kind of series. Like the fruit of this series is going to be in us making some choices and making some changes in our own lives. And so to get really practical about that, I want you to spend some time, and maybe as we come to the communion table in a little bit, maybe just take this home, pray about it, think about it. I know our MCs have been talking about group things that maybe they're going to do and ways to keep this going, commitments to make that kind of flow out of the series. I know we have that Facebook group that has been a great resource, and people have thrown some articles and some information and asked questions and shared things that they've tried, the good and the bad of that. So I hope that continues to be something that is a resource you can go back to and look as you're thinking about making other changes, or as you come across new information and post it. I hope that continues to live beyond this series. But I do want you to pick, one, two, three, don't try to massively overhaul your entire lifestyle this week, because you won't stick to it. And so rather than making big commitments that you're not going to keep, I would rather see us all make simple, make manageable commitments that we'll actually keep. And we can build off those, and you can continue to add other things and learn from and tweak. But what are things that are simple and manageable, but yet can be significant and meaningful in their impact over time? Replacing, buying the reusable cup that I have that I actually didn't use this morning. I have my water bottle, but too often I'm going on a Sunday morning and I'm getting my caffeine of choice, which isn't coffee, in my reusable cup. But that reusable cup's looking a little beat up. But just think, that one thing, unfortunately, cancels out a whole lot of styrofoam cups at Circle K. Way too many styrofoam cups. One, because they're styrofoam, and two, because I shouldn't be drinking that much soda from Circle K. But the impact of that one choice over the years has, amounted to a lot, a mountain of styrofoam cups that I have not used, that aren't in a landfill right now. So simple things, small things that over time can have a significant impact. I also ask, what do we still need to learn? Is there something we need to learn? I still don't even know or understand the kind of impact that I'm having. I don't know which companies I should be supporting. I don't know what it would look like to try to move away from these single-use plastics. I don't know what would be the best thing. I might need to learn. I might need to do some research. I might need to ask some questions of other people who maybe have tried some of this. And then that last one is, who is going to help? Who's going to help me make those decisions, make those commitments, maybe narrow down from the wild, crazy things to something more doable? Who's going to help me, ask me questions about what it's going to look like? Who's going to hold me accountable as we do this in community? So take that, reflect on it, think about what changes is God calling you to make? What's the starting point, at least, for where you are going to make changes in light of God's call to care for his creation and reshape our relationship with it. So that's the first three parts of those covenant trees. We've talked about the parties, we've talked about that narrative, and we've talked about the expectations. What is it that God expects of us? To tend and to care and protect and serve this creation that he's entrusted to us. The next is kind of the blessings and curses. And in Deuteronomy, as I said before, in Deuteronomy 30, this is where, actually in 27 and 28, is where he lays out the long list of curses. And then in 30, we have Moses saying this: I set before you today life and prosperity, death and destruction. For I command you today to love the Lord your God, to walk in obedience to him, and to keep his commands, decrees, and laws. And then you will live and increase, and the Lord your God will bless you in the land you are entering to possess. Then he goes on and talks, if you turn away or if you don't, and I'm calling the heavens and earth as witnesses, to choose life. There's blessings and curses. And as we consider our place in God's good world, we're at a kind of similar situation as we look to the future. There are dire consequences for continuing to live in the destructive and unsustainable way that we've been living and modeling for the rest of the world to follow. We must make these commitments and covenant with God on behalf of creation because it is the way that leads to life for us, for the more vulnerable people in the world, and for the non-human living world. And as followers of Jesus, we need to take these scientific warnings seriously, but we also need to consider what the Bible has to say about where this is all going. And misunderstanding what the Bible teaches about the future has led many Christians to ignore or actively resist environmental concerns. And the main text that comes up again and again in this matters is 2 Peter 3, 10 to 11, where Peter writes, but the day of the Lord will come like a thief. The heavens will disappear with a roar. The elements will be destroyed by fire, and the earth and everything done in it will be laid bare. Since everything will be destroyed in this way, what kind of people ought you to be? You ought to live holy and godly lives as you look forward to the day of God and speed its coming. That day will bring about the destruction of the heavens by fire, and the elements will melt in the heat. But in keeping with his promise, we are looking forward to a new heaven and a new earth where righteousness dwells. And so reading that, the question that has come up for many Christians is, why bother caring for this world if it's all going to burn? Just before that, he talks about how the world was destroyed once in the flood and how now the next time it's reserved for fire. And they're saying, so if the world is reserved for fire, if it's all going to burn, why does it matter if I plant a tree or not, if it's just going to burn? Why does it matter if we strip mine and we remove mountaintops and we spill oil in the waters? Or what does it matter? We should just get the most out of it before it all burns anyway. And this is the kind of mentality that, rightly or wrongly, Christians have been characterized by. Those in the environmental movement have viewed the church as people who are resisting or are enemies of this environmental movement, which is our calling because of things like this and because people have looked at this. And there's other political reasons why it's been lumped in with other kinds of things. And so people on one side have looked at it very suspiciously, and people on the other side have looked at them and all of this. So there's a lot that goes into it, but a lot of it is this passage. If it's all going to burn, why bother? The earth is just a bunch of resources for us to use. Or the other problem with our biblical view of the end is that we think, well, we're just going to leave this world anyway. We're going to die and our spirits are going to go and they're going to be in heaven with Jesus forever. Which is nothing like what the Bible teaches. We are not destined for a disembodied future in heaven with God on clouds and with harps. We are destined for a life in the new earth, the new heavens, with new bodies, because God made bodies. He thinks they're a good idea. We've somehow crept in this idea that bodies in the physical world are evil, and so the spiritual is against that or apart from that, and the whole goal is to pull away, and that is not Christianity. There are religions that believe that, but that is not what the Bible teaches. And so if we do believe that it doesn't matter, we're just going to go to heaven anyway, we're going to leave this place behind, it doesn't matter if we trash it on the way out. I mean, we should maybe be thinking about future generations, but for us, it doesn't matter. And even for them, they'll eventually die and go to heaven too. These misunderstandings are really problematic because, one, they're not what the Bible teaches. Even the 2 Peter passage that's talking about this fire that's going to come on the earth, it's many scholars believe this is about a refining fire. There's a transforming. He's using the metaphor of fire and how it's going to burn. Because the whole time he's been talking about the wickedness and sin of this age. He's saying all that's going to get burned away. It's going to be purified. And what remains is we're going to live on this new heavens and the new earth where righteousness dwells. And he talks about the flood. The flood did not disintegrate the world into nothingness. The flood in the biblical account, in this account of Noah, it washes clean the world. And on the other side of the flood, there's the possibility now of life the way it was intended to. God had looked at the world, saw the violence, and saw the way things had been bent and twisted, and he didn't just undo the world, he washed it. Made it for a clean start. And so using that same analogy, he now says the next time is going to be fire. It's not just going to be putting some water on it and trying to scrub it up a little bit. It's going to be refining. It's going to burn all of that out of it. All these elements, these things, these elemental powers, these things that are set against God, they're going to be dealt with definitively. And on the other side, what emerges is going to be pure, refined. It's a transforming. There will be continuity in this world. We will have bodies. We will have good work to do in God's renewed heavens and earth. That is the future that we look forward to. The future that always was intended when God created the world and made it good. It's not to go back to the garden. It's not to go to heaven to be with Jesus. It's to bring the story where it always intended to go, as we see in Revelation 21 and 22. It's the garden city. A city where nature is right in there, the trees and the river right along there, and God dwelling with us in the world. I love this commentator. Matthew Emerson wrote a scholarly article that asked the question, does God own a Death Star? I love it. And his conclusion, he's looking at 2 Peter 3, and this idea is God just going to blow up the world. That's actually what that image is Alderaan blowing up. With the Death Star in the Star Wars Episode 4. But his conclusion says, God does not own a Death Star, or at least if he does, he's not going to use it on the cosmos at Christ's return. 2 Peter 3, 1-13, while certainly containing language that indicates a radical judgment of the present evil age and the purging of the effects of sin, does not teach that God will annihilate the universe at the end of time. Instead, Peter uses language of pass away and fire imagery and the comparison to Noah's flood to teach his readers that God will purify the heavens and the earth, his good creation, from the effects and the source of sin and thereby transform it into the new heavens and new earth where righteousness dwells. Believers can therefore look forward to the day when God brings the restored new heavens down to the restored new earth, dwelling with his people in a garden city temple, the culmination of the biblical storyline. And there, of course, he's drawing on this imagery of Revelation 21 and 22. This new heavens and the new earth. And I'll read just a little bit of chapter 22, the first few verses. Then the angel who's showing John this vision showed me the river of the water of life, as clear as crystal, flowing from the throne of God and of the Lamb down the middle of the great street of the city. On each side of the river stood the tree of life, bearing 12 crops of fruit, yielding its fruit every month. And the leaves of the tree are for the healing of the nations. No longer will there be any curse. The throne of God and the Lamb will be in the city, and his servants will serve him. They will see his face, and his name will be on their foreheads. There will be no more night. They will not need the light of a lamp or the light of the sun, for the Lord God will give them light, and they will reign forever and ever. And again, in this apocalyptic language, this language of what the future is, this idea that God is going to dwell, there's not going to be a temple there, he says, because God's going to be present. Why do we need to have a temple that represents the presence of God when he's present everywhere to us? And why do we need a sun when God himself is going to be our light? It's a radical reshaping of the universe where now instead of mediated through these other things, a temple and a sun, we're going to have direct access to God. And we can't understand exactly what it looks like, but we're going to serve God. And part of serving God is going to be to fulfill our original calling and serve this creation. The creation's hope is in Christ's return, and the renewal has begun with the cross and will be completed when he returns and ushers in the kingdom in its fullness, when he dwells with us in this garden city of the New Jerusalem. And if you notice the river that runs down the center, the water of life, and the tree of life on either side of it, bearing crops, 12 crops a year in every month, this super abundance of creation, like brought to like a ridiculous level. Creation just abundantly overflowing in goodness, and the trees and the leaves of the trees are for the healing of the nation. The center is the trees. And so while we wait for Christ's return, while we wait for that to happen, we plant trees. Like Martin Luther, who probably didn't actually say this, but the quote is often attributed to him, that even if I knew tomorrow the world would go to pieces, I would still plant my apple tree. We're called to care for creation. When Jesus returns, what do we want him to find us doing? Caring for creation, fulfilling this calling, stepping into our role, because it's about loving others and loving God. It's loving the God who entrusted it to us. It's loving others well, because we have to care for creation and work for justice and attend to the flourishing of individuals and communities. But it also means that attending to the needs of the earth that sustains us, and particularly caring for the poor who are more vulnerable to the consequences of environmental degradation. Karen Geyer, she got some viral social media fame a little while ago for responding to a climate denier who put something out like, you know, if someone could just prove the science to me in simple, easy language. And she responded with a series of tweets very simply laying out the science behind climate change. And a lot of people jumped on it and loved it, that she responded and gave this easy-to-understand response. But she takes a dismal view of the future. Like many today, she believes that we missed our chance to change. We missed our window by denying and dragging our feet and choosing to continue to live our unsustainable lives. And she writes that we are ironically planting trees that our children will never sit under. Now, I believe that we have serious challenges ahead. I believe that there will be consequences to our environmental sins, and that there is urgent need to make real changes now, not just on the surface level, just behavioral changes, but heart-level transformation and counterformation to the world of endless desire and consumption and accumulation and waste. But I'm not going to give up hope. I'm going to keep planting trees. As an act of defiant hope for the generations that will follow and will sit in their shade, as the earth heats, the trees we plant will be all the more needed. Actually, in Jewish tradition, they would plant a tree when a child is born. And they talk and say prayers and things about this planting of the tree for this child. And as it grows, may the child grow. And as it bears fruit, may the child become. And there's a language to that and a connection to that. And there's also a Jewish tradition, a story of a man who's planting the tree. And someone comes by and says, well, how long before that tree is going to bear fruit? A number of years, often the tree's not going to be big enough yet. The fruit's not going to be ready. And the man says, 70 years. And the guy goes, man, you really think you're going to live 70 years to enjoy the fruit of this tree? And he replies, I'm eating the fruit of trees that others planted before me. So I will plant this tree so those behind me will have the fruit to eat. And again, I know it goes beyond individual action. I know governments need to act. The industry needs to be forced from the wide and easy path of waste and destruction to the more costly and narrow path of conscientious change. I know that the needed changes are sweeping and far-reaching, yet I believe cultures change because hearts change. And people with changed hearts resist and transform culture and create new cultures and new norms. So I believe we must keep planting trees and making changes, but ultimately I believe our hope is in Christ, who loves us and loves this good world, and is committed to bringing it into its intended glory. So I'll pray and I'll ask God to act like a parent who's willing to help their child clean up their bedroom when they're overwhelmed with the task. Not because it's the parent's fault that the room got that messy. The warnings were there. The encouragement and the advice was ignored. But because they want to help their child have their best life, they're willing to join in the work of bringing it about. And so I pray, Lord, help us. Your Spirit, hover over your creation and sustain it and renew the face of the earth. Jesus, bring about your full cosmic redemption. We offer ourselves as agents of renewal and change. So cultivate the soil of our hearts and fashion us into instruments of your peace that you can use in your world. And so as we make these decisions, as we are aware of what's in front of us, the blessings and the cursings, the way forward, as we commit ourselves to that, there's memorials. And the memorials that we have, we come each week to this table as a reminder. It was a reminder of who we are in the world that we live in, the abundance of God who provides for us, but is also at work bringing about renewal. So we come each time remembering that we're being restored into the kind of people. We're receiving the kind of life that's in right relationship with God and with ourselves and with others and with creation. And so this table is a reminder that God has invited us to come and receive, that God has given us such good gifts. And so that's one of the memorials. The other memorials that we're not going to do today because of the pouring rain are apple trees that are going to be planted out in our space just out near the community garden over there. We were going to, after taking communion, we were going to all process out there, put them in the ground, say a prayer, a blessing out there, and end our gathering outside. And that's not going to happen because it would be very wet. So they will get planted at some point this week, and you will be able to see them as a memorial, as a reminder of our commitment to the future, our commitment to the earth, of our calling to be those who serve and protect this good earth that we've been given. So we have this opportunity to come to the table, the same Jesus who came and lived and died for us that we might become the children of God. Also came and died to renew and restore everything, to get this creation back on track, back towards its original intended end of a place where a people live in right relationship with God and with self and with others and with creation, where the abundance of life is experienced and enjoyed and God is glorified in it. And so he came to make that happen, to begin that. There's a song I've been listening to a lot of Rich Mullins lately for some reason. But there's a line in one of his songs where he's talking about, you know, driving by these stables like the one that Christ was born in. And he says, when the old world started dying and the new world started coming in, and I'll sing his song in the land of my sojourns. As we're in this place, as we continue to live this out, we're reminded and we remember the old world is passing away. The new world is coming because of what Jesus has done. And we participate in that. We receive that life. He's here now by his Spirit to give us grace, to lead us into that life if we will come and receive it and recognize him as King and him as Savior and Redeemer. And so you're invited to come and receive. And all of it is just a foretaste, just a glimpse of that day when we will live in a renewed earth and a renewed heaven, when God will be directly present with us, not mediated through symbols and sacraments, but present directly in a way that goes even more so than the presence of the Spirit in this place. And so in anticipation of that, we come. We remember, we receive, and we anticipate. So when you're ready, you can come and take a piece of the bread, which is broken to remind us that Jesus' body was broken for us. Dip it in the cup, which is the poured out juice to remind us of the blood of Jesus poured out for us. This bread is the result of grain that was grown and harvested and transformed into this, through culture and artisan, by the shaping and the care of human hands. And the juice is the same, grown and harvested, produced, shared. It's the recipient of a long chain of human action, and we sit at the end of it. We do this because someone planted grapes and grain, because someone cared for the land, because someone took what the land produced and made something of it for us. So we're reminded, even as we take these elements, that they represent the goodness of this good world brought out and brought to us. And we give thanks to God. So when you're ready, take a piece of the bread, dip it in the cup, and receive the elements and give thanks to God.
Thanks for downloading the Threads Church podcast. For more information, visit threadschurch.org.